Hi, this is Gordon Deal. The award-winning Wall Street Journal This Morning starts right after this. For most of you, the desire to learn didn't stop after college. That's the motivation behind The Great Courses. The Great Courses features engaging, informative audio and video lectures from some of the top professors and experts in their fields, like Understanding Investments by Connell Fullenkamp, financial economics professor at Duke University. The course is designed to broaden and deepen the knowledge of more experienced investors while introducing the fundamentals of investing to those new to the subject. The Great Courses has been in production for over 20 years, with over 500 courses on many subjects, including science, mathematics, history, art and music, philosophy, and more. Listen to or watch The Great Courses with online downloads and streaming via their apps or on DVDs or CDs at your own pace, and no exams. The Great Courses has a special offer for Wall Street Journal listeners. Order Understanding Investments and get 80% off the original price. But this 80% savings is only available for a limited time. Don't wait. Go to thegreatcourses.com/WSJ. That's thegreatcourses.com/WSJ.
Live from the newsroom of the Wall Street Journal, this is the Wall Street Journal This Morning, America's first news with Gordon Deal.
Hagel defends the exchange. Good morning, I'm Gordon Deal, along with Gina Cervetti. Thursday, June 12th. Welcome aboard. Here's what's up this hour.
Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel makes his first public comment since Sergeant Bo Bergdahl was swapped for five Taliban commanders. Hear what he said at a House committee hearing.
Islamist insurgents are on the march again in Iraq, a surprise to the Obama administration. Will the U.S. respond?
The World Cup begins today. Find out how much money Brazil spent on preparations compared to South Africa 4 years ago.
And the five unanswered questions regarding the prisoner swap involving Sergeant Bergdahl and these five Taliban officers.
Shortly after he disappeared, two members of his platoon were killed, but it was at an outpost. It wasn't while they were on patrol. Several others were killed in about 2 months after he had disappeared, when the most intensive phase of the search for Bergdahl had died down. Now, it's hard to, based on Army records, it's hard to conclude that they died searching for Bergdahl.
One of the questions, were U.S. service members killed while searching for Sergeant Bergdahl? Reporter Alexander Bolton at The Hill joins us in just a moment. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel spent 3 hours yesterday before the House Armed Services Committee defending the Obama administration's decision to rescue Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. He was pressed for additional details on the exchange of Sergeant Bergdahl for five Taliban detainees being held in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Mr. Hagel also faced questions about revelations that U.S. intelligence provided an assessment predicting two of the five detainees were likely to return to senior Taliban positions. Committee Chair Buck McKeon of California.
This transfer sets dangerous precedent for how the president intends to clear out Gitmo. The remaining detainees, by the Obama administration's own analysis, include the most dangerous against U.S. forces and national security interests.
Mr. Hagel said officials were satisfied by the assurances from Qatari officials on monitoring plans for the detainees.
President and I would not have moved forward unless we had complete confidence that we were acting lawfully in the national interest and in the best traditions of our country. Our operation to save Sergeant Bergdahl's life was fully consistent with U.S. laws and our national security interests.
While members of Sergeant Bergdahl's unit have accused him of being a deserter, Mr. Hagel said there are no charges against Sergeant Bergdahl. Regarding accusations that the exchange went against U.S. precedent to not deal with terrorists, an aide to Mr. Hagel compared the Bergdahl rescue to U.S. efforts to secure the release of an American soldier captured in Somalia during a battle in Mogadishu. In that incident, a Black Hawk helicopter pilot was held by a Somali warlord and was returned in a deal involving the release of detainees held by the United Nations. Even after Mr. Hagel's testimony yesterday, there are still unanswered questions about the prisoner swap involving Sergeant Bergdahl. Alexander Bolton, reporter at The Hill, has a list of them. He joins us on the T-Mobile hotline. Alex, what do we know?
We We know that he has a history of wandering away from his post. When he was on a training base in California, he had walked away. He went AWOL, but then he returned. And then when he was in Afghanistan, he had wandered away from his outpost before returning. The second time, he did not return. And the question was, or the question is, was he intending to return? Now, one of the things that does not bode well for Bergdahl's defense is that he had sent his computer and personal journal back home. So that's an argument some of his squad mates think, that he did not plan to return. But right now, Bergdahl has told military investigators his side of the story, and they're not going to go into the details until they've had a chance to examine this independently and comprehensively. So right now, investigators only have Bergdahl's side of the story, as well as the testimony of his squad mate.
Speaking of his squad mates, I know they say that there are U.S. service members who died looking for Sergeant Bergdahl. Do we have any evidence of that?
Not really. There are, shortly after he disappeared, two members of his platoon were killed, but it was at an outpost. It wasn't while they were on patrol. Several others were killed in about 2 months after he had disappeared, when the most intensive phase of the search for Bergdahl had died down. Now, it's hard to, based on Army records, it's hard to conclude that they died searching for Bergdahl, but what the squad mates themselves testify is that they were given orders when on patrol to look for Bergdahl whenever possible. So it's a little bit hard to really make that conclusion as to whether they were killed because of Bergdahl or not. It's debatable, but some of the defenders in the administration, or some of the defenders of the administration, have questioned the motives of these squad mates, or have wondered if they are trying to swift boat Bergdahl and the president, and this is an allusion to 2004 when John Kerry, then the Democratic presidential nominee, was criticized by some of his former combat comrades. And John McCain, the senior Republican on the Senate Armed Services Committee, on Tuesday lashed out at Obama's allies who have question the motives of these squad mates who have accused Bergdahl of desertion.
We're speaking with Alex Bolton, reporter at The Hill. He's got a piece called Five Unanswered Questions on Bergdahl. What about the background of these Taliban commanders released from Guantanamo Bay? Are we ever going to see the documents providing a little history of these guys?
Well, Saxby Chambliss, the senior Republican on the Senate Intelligence Committee, he has written to the president and called on the president to make all these records public so that the people know just how dangerous they are and what threat they pose to the public. I don't think the administration is going to do that, because probably the most incisive criticism or pointed criticism that the Republicans have is that the president has endangered the war effort in Afghanistan by letting these senior commanders on the loose. And yes, they're going to be in Qatar for a year, but after that, there's no limit on them returning back to the battlefield, and one of them has already said he plans to do just that.
And explain this statement that Bob Bergdahl, his father, made on Twitter. I know you mentioned it before about working to free all Guantanamo prisoners. What's that about?
Well, 4 days before his son's release, he tweeted, "I am still working to free all Guantanamo prisoners. God will repay the death of every Afghan child." Sounds very sympathetic to the Taliban cause, and Bergdahl's tweet was deleted shortly after he posted it. Mm. Now, there's some question as to whether it's authentic or not, but the Bergdahl family hasn't denied it. And I think what's going on here is that Robert Bergdahl is trying to gain some sympathy or empathy from his son's Taliban captors.
Thanks, Alex. Well, that is Alexander Bolton, reporter at The Hill, with us this morning from Washington. 13 minutes now after the hour on The Wall Street Journal this morning. Coming up next, the Obama administration caught off guard by the violence in Iraq.
We help farmers make the best use of their land, which means healthier crops, higher yields, and less harvesting hours. Which is good news for a growing population and good news for the environment. BASF, the chemical company.
Thanks for being with us on this Friday eve. This portion of the program is brought to you by Stamps.com. Get your mailing and shipping done. Can seem like a no-win situation. Going to the post office takes up valuable time, and leasing a postage meter can be expensive with multi-year commitments and hidden fees. Luckily, there's a better way. Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package right from your desk using your own computer and printer. Even get special postage discounts you can't find at the post office. Plus, Stamps.com is more powerful than a postage meter at just a fraction of the cost. You can save up to 80%. compared to a postage meter, and you'll avoid those time-consuming trips to the post office. Right now, use the promo code WSJ for this special offer, a no-risk trial, plus a $110 bonus offer, which includes a digital scale and up to $55 free postage. So don't wait. Go to stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in WSJ. That's stamps.com. Enter WSJ. Islamist militants are on the move again. Yesterday, they swept out of northern Iraq to seize their second city in 2 days, threatening Baghdad and pushing the country's besieged government to now signal it would allow U.S. airstrikes to beat back this advance. More from Wall Street Journal this morning's Jeff Bellinger on the overrunning of Tikrit, birthplace of former dictator Saddam Hussein.
An alarmed Iraqi government also asked the U.S. to accelerate delivery of pledged military support, especially Apache helicopters, F-16 fighters, and surveillance equipment to help push back fighters from the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham, an al-Qaeda offshoot known as ISIS. Officials declined to say whether the U.S. would consider conducting airstrikes with drones or manned aircraft. The conquests over the last 2 days were by far the most significant by the Sunni group, which has also taken control of parts of neighboring Syria during the civil war there. Gordon?
Thank you, Jeff. By the way, recent events in Iraq show the potential risks of the administration's foreign policy approach. In a speech last month, you'll recall, President Obama outlined a policy that favors a lighter U.S. military footprint and, where possible, calls for regional allies to take the lead in fighting terrorists. Retired General Peter Chiarelli is the Army's former vice chief of staff.
We really thought we turned the corner and Iraq was going to open a new page in its life as a nation.
Critics say Mr. Obama is relying too heavily on partners of varying capabilities and often conflicting agendas. They say the Iraqi army and an outgunned moderate opposition in Syria are too weak to make a difference, especially with the Obama administration's unwillingness to do more to support them. It's 20 minutes now after the hour on the Wall Street Journal this morning. Gina Cervetti is here. She has America's first news.
Good morning. The FBI has launched a criminal investigation into scheduling practices at the Department of Veterans Affairs. Previously, law enforcement officials had acknowledged that the Justice Department was examining whether any potential crimes were committed. Meanwhile, the Senate has passed a bill allowing more veterans to seek health care outside of the VA. The House passed a similar bill this week. Following his stunning loss in the Republican primary, Virginia Representative Eric Cantor says he will resign his position as majority leader.
Effective July 31st, I will be stepping down as majority leader. It is with great humility that I do so, knowing the tremendous honor it has been to hold this position.
Cantor says he'll throw his support behind Kevin McCarthy of California, who is right now the number three Republican in the House, if he chooses to seek the majority leader position. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel is defending the Taliban prisoner swap that freed U.S. Sergeant Bo Bergdahl.
The president's decision to move forward with the transfer of these detainees was a tough call.
But Hagel, in front of the House Armed Services Committee, said that officials faced an extraordinary situation and that the U.S. believed the risks to Bergdahl's safety were growing. He said the Obama administration could have done a better job of informing lawmakers. Federal safety regulators are investigating whether just over a million vehicles have airbags that could injure you in a crash. Authorities say they've received six reports of airbags rupturing, injuring three people. Older vehicles made by Honda, Mazda, Nissan, Chrysler, and Toyota are the ones being investigated. Crude oil futures this morning are up now to over $106 a barrel. On supply concerns tied to Iraq unrest, today brings an update on retail sales, and economists do expect some improvement. U.S. stock futures are positive this morning after a 102-point drop for the Dow yesterday. The Nasdaq fell 6, the S&P lost 7, but those losses followed new record highs. Soccer fans will be tuned into the World Cup, which starts today in Brazil. Meanwhile, on the ice, the Rangers stay in the battle for the Stanley Cup, beating the L.A. Kings last night 2-1 in New York, which now trails the Kings 3-1. And if you purchased a Powerball ticket in Knoxville, Tennessee, your life could be in for some big changes. Lottery officials say Knoxville is where the jackpot-winning ticket was sold for last night's game, with a prize of $260 million, thereabouts.
Man.
That's all? $260 million, Gordon?
Chump change. That one snuck up on me. Normally,
yeah,
I feel
me
like
too.
I get some sort of sense of these big ones, but I wasn't paying attention, I guess, for that one. Thank you, Gina. 23 minutes after the hour now on the Wall Street Journal this morning. Coming up next, profiling Professor David Bratt. America was built by innovators and dreamers like you. To celebrate, LegalZoom dedicated this month to innovation by making it easy for you to file trademark or copyright applications, incorporate your business, or form an LLC. Call or visit LegalZoom.com. They'll provide the personal attention you need and help take care of all the details. For a limited time, get a special price on trademark and copyright applications by using the referral code WSJ at checkout. LegalZoom provides legal help through independent attorneys and self-help, but they're not a law firm.
Leaving the country on business takes a lot of planning. Bringing your data plan doesn't. With T-Mobile's Simple Choice for Business plan, you'll get unlimited data in over 100 countries automatically. There's no changing plans and no extra charges. Just get off the plane and go. Only at T-Mobile.
Qualifying service and capable device required. Standard speeds approximately 128 kilobytes per second. No tethering. See T-Mobile.com for full feature terms and included destinations.
Hey, glad you're with us. The newest star of the Tea Party movement is David Bratt, the economics professor who upset House Majority Leader Eric Cantor of Virginia in Tuesday's GOP primary. Who is this guy? A profile from Wall Street Journal reporter Reed Epstein. Reed, tell us about Professor Bratt.
He is somebody who, like a lot of people in academia, has written a lot of things about a lot of different topics. He tends to write a lot about the intersection of economics and religion. And then some of his papers have talked about how European economies and the United States economy would be better off if elected leaders both took more of a Protestant tone towards what they did, as well as a more libertarian one.
So Mr. Bratt is not your typical Republican?
Not your typical Republican. He's somebody who ran a populist campaign. He, you know, a lot of Republicans you see take campaign donations from banking industries and Wall Street, and so they're loath to attack those industries. But Mr. Bratt basically didn't raise very much money at all, and spent a lot of his time criticizing Eric Cantor, as well as the Wall Street bailouts, talking about how they were an intrusion on a pure libertarian version of capitalism that he perceives as most optimal.
Was he as shocked as the rest of the world when he found out he won, or was he pretty confident going in?
He was pretty surprised. He said on Tuesday night that it was a miracle from God. His chief campaign strategist had planned to fly out of Richmond back to Atlanta on Wednesday because he hadn't expected a victory. He had to change his flight to Friday to deal with Bratt becoming the political sensation, at least of the week. And it seems like no one on his staff of two, had expected this.
I know it's been only a short period of time, but has he been thinking ahead to the general election and his Democratic opponent that he'll face?
Oh, the general, like, this is a district, like a lot of congressional districts, which is drawn in a way that either one party or other is almost certain to win. Mitt Romney won this district by 15 percentage points in 2012. And it's almost certain that Bratt will win. There's a Democrat running as a guy named Jack Trammell, who is a professor at the same small college, Randolph-Macon, that Bratt works at. He's raised no money. He's espoused no political positions at this point. He's not filed an FEC report to show that he's raised money or that he would raise money. And at this point, we haven't heard anything really from Democrats that would suggest that he's going to be a serious candidate for this position.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Reed Epstein. Is this one of the cheapest congressional wins we've seen in a long time?
Yeah, you know, it's remarkable. Eric Cantor spent more money at steak dinners at his fundraisers in Washington than Bratt spent on his entire campaign. It really, usually in almost every situation you see, the candidate who spends the most money is the one who's going to win, especially incumbents. Cantor spent more than $5 million compared to just over $120,000 for Bratt. And it's a very rare occasion indeed when the person on the short end of that sort of financial arrangement comes out the winner.
Thanks, Reed. Wall Street Journal reporter Reed Epstein. How about that stat? Eric Cantor spent more money on steak dinners at Washington fundraisers than Mr. Bratt did on his actual campaign. 30 minutes after the hour now on the Wall Street Journal this morning. Thanks for being with us on this Thursday, June 12. Gordon Deal with Gina Cervetti. Coming up this half hour, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel defends the prisoner swap that freed Sergeant Bo Bergdahl.
We were mindful that this was not simply a detainee transfer, but a military operation with very high and complicated risks and a very short window of opportunity that we didn't want to jeopardize.
Plus, the trendy new material being used to build cars and the World Cup by the numbers. We'll have those stats in about 20 minutes. Many states and their teachers' unions are huddling about strategies going forward after a California judge declared the state's strong teacher tenure laws unconstitutional. It's a rebuke that promises to spur similar challenges around the country. For analysis, we're joined now by Bob Bowden, founder of Choice Media, an education policy news site. He's also host of a related webcast. Bob, is this a victory for reformers?
Of course, these things get appealed, and they last forever in the courts, you know, as everyone knows. And so I see it more as a media victory and a rhetorical win for the education reform side. In the many issues involving education reform, like school choice, like online learning, homeschooling, charter schools, lots of issues, Common Core, of course, this issue of teacher tenure is the one that has the most immediate resonance with ordinary people who, everyone I know, had good teachers, bad teachers, and in between when they were kids. And so this narrative that teachers unions offer, which is that, oh, there really aren't any bad teachers, and bad teachers are weeded out of the system. You can have tenure as simply a due process provision. It's not believable by ordinary Americans, and so this is an issue that, in the entire panoply of education reform debates, it's the one I think that is the lowest hanging fruit, you might say.
You know, it's interesting because I probably have more friends that are teachers than any other occupation, and it's amazing when I'll ask them, you know, what percentage of your staff would you say would not currently hold a job in the private sector based on performance? And it's usually about 50%.
Yeah.
And they always point to tenure. And even those who have it say they think it's just the dumbest thing going.
There are teachers that will tell me, like, off the record, like, don't tell anyone I said this, but
yes,
tenure really they're afraid to say it out loud.
Yep.
Because they'll get targeted by their local union as being trouble causers and not pulling with the team, et cetera, this, you know, monolith idea. But it is, you're right, so many times even teachers themselves think it's a load, so to speak.
We're speaking with Bob Bowden. He's the founder of Choice Media, which is an education news site and webcast. We're talking about this teacher tenure ruling in California. So you and I are based here in New Jersey, where there is a very powerful teachers union, the New Jersey Education Association. How do you think the California ruling might play in New Jersey or other states that have these very strong teachers unions?
I think it could be a model for other lawsuits. And, you know, the thing is the judges have ruled against tenure reform, even recently around the country. So just in May, a judge in North Carolina struck down the tenure reform law that would have gotten rid of tenure in North Carolina, a judge saying that this was unconstitutional, striking down tenure, at least for those who are already grandfathered in, already had been given tenure. And similarly, last year in Louisiana, a judge struck down Bobby Jindal's tenure reform. So those were cases going the other direction. What's different with this case is that instead of being a case about what are the teachers' rights, it was a case structured on what are the students' rights. The Vergara case in California said the student plaintiffs are being underserved by these tenure rules that protect underperforming teachers. This model could absolutely be replicated. There could be other states. There probably are meetings all over the country right now in law offices and activist groups saying, how do we launch our own suit to say that kids in our state are underserved by underperforming teachers that can't be fired because of tenure? And so, yes, I think there are lots of similar suits.
Ultimately, how far does it go? Does it climb all the way to the Supreme Court?
Well, it's going to be appealed in California anyway to the Court of Appeals, and then likely to the California Supreme Court after that. And so, as for the United States Supreme Court, not so sure, because it's not so much a U.S. Question of U.S. law. Of course, the U.S. Supreme Court could hear it, but I'm not an expert on what the court decides to take.
Thanks, Bob. That is Bob Bowden, founder of Choice Media. 21 minutes before the hour now on the Wall Street Journal this morning.
When I was pregnant, I got more advice than I knew what to do with. What I needed was information I could trust on how to take care of me and my baby. Luckily, United Healthcare has a simple program that helps moms stay on track with their doctors and get the right care and guidance before and after the baby is born. Simple is good right now.
Innovations that work for you. That's health in numbers. UnitedHealthcare.
By the way, I got a nice email the other day from a guy named Roger in Maine. He says, this program is so, so good that it should be repeated throughout the day on many stations. Love to wake up to the program. Keep up the good work. If you want to drop us an email, by the way, you can do so by sending it to morning@wsj.com. It's time now for an automotive update, and it's brought to you by Cadillac. You're always ready to go the extra mile. Fortunately, so is your Cadillac. Cadillac Certified Service Experts keep your Cadillac as ready to go as you are. Visit CadillacCertifiedService.com for service offers. Car makers are planning a broad shift from steel to aluminum in larger vehicles over the next decade in North America, an effort to cut weight and improve fuel economy. Wall Street Journal reporter Mike Ramsey in Detroit says the auto industry predicts 18% of all vehicles will have all aluminum bodies by 2025, compared with less than 1% now. Mike, explain the trend.
Well, aluminum is light and compared to steel, and with rising fuel economy and CO2 regulations in North America, Europe, and in Asia, automakers have to figure out a way to continue to increase fuel economy, but not give up on the size of vehicles that consumers really want. And consumers have, and especially in North America, they like larger vehicles. They like SUVs, they like larger cars, and small cars just have not caught on here. And interestingly, in Asia as well, the vehicles are a little bit smaller, but not like in Europe where compact cars have done quite well. So if you want to keep selling big cars, you have to reduce the weight in order to get fuel efficiency to rise.
Is this a money saver for automakers, or will it cost more, Mike?
Well, initially, it's definitely not going to be a money saver. Aluminum has been used in vehicles for a very long time. It's certainly not a new material, and it's also a very strong material. I think that you could probably make the mistake in your head of thinking of an aluminum soda can as being something you could crush versus the old steel one that you couldn't. But aluminum, pound for pound, is very strong, and it will hold up, but it is more expensive than steel initially. The plus side of that is when you get to a really high volume, aluminum is infinitely recyclable, whereas steel degrades over time. It can only be recycled a couple times.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Mike Ramsey in Detroit. Does America currently have the capacity to supply this aluminum since so many automakers will be using it?
Absolutely not. And when it comes to steel, you can call up a steel company 6 months before you start an auto program, lock in the steel contract, and you're good to go. With aluminum, the aluminum sheet for automotive simply does not exist in North America. Ford, who's really, with the introduction of the all-aluminum F-150 late this year, they had to lock in years in advance contracts with Novelis and Alcoa to produce aluminum sheet lines, and those companies made big investments in plants.
Thanks, Mike. That is Wall Street Journal reporter Mike Ramsey from Detroit. 15 minutes now before the hour on the Wall Street Journal this morning. Coming up next, Gina Cervetti has our top stories.
Traveling overseas for business comes with a checklist of things to worry about. But with T-Mobile, you can take getting international data off that list. Because with a simple choice for business plan, unlimited data in over 100 countries is automatically included at no extra charge. Only at T-Mobile.
Qualifying service and capable device required. Standard speeds approximately 128 kilobytes per second. No tethering. See T-Mobile.com for full feature terms and included destinations.
This portion of the program is brought to you by Stamps.com. Getting your mailing and shipping done can seem like a no-win situation. Going to the post office takes up valuable time, and leasing a postage meter can be expensive with multi-year commitments and hidden fees. Luckily, there's a better way. Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package right from your desk using your own computer and printer. Even get special postage discounts that you can't find at the post office. Plus, Stamps.com is more powerful than a postage meter at just a fraction of the cost. You can save up to 80% compared to a postage meter, and you'll avoid those time-consuming trips to the post office. Right now, use the promo code WSJ for this special offer, a no-risk trial, plus a $110 bonus offer, which includes a digital scale and up to $55 free postage. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in WSJ. That's Stamps.com. Enter WSJ. It's 10 minutes now before the hour on the Wall Street Journal this morning. Gina Cervetti is back with America's First News.
Good morning. Police in suburban Portland, Oregon say that a 15-year-old gunman used a semi-automatic rifle in the attack that killed another student and injured a teacher before the shooter killed himself. Police said the teen is identified as Jared Michael Padgett, who is also armed, they say, with a handgun and a large knife. Scott Anderson is the Troutdale, Oregon police chief.
The shooter obtained the weapons from his family home. The weapons had been secured, but he defeated the security measures.
The boy killed was identified as 14-year-old Emilio Hoffman. Anderson says they have not been able to establish any link between the two boys. Representative Pete Sessions of Texas says he'll run for the post of House Majority Leader and that if elected, his main concern would be securing the U.S. border with Mexico. This follows word from Virginia Republican Eric Cantor, who says he'll resign the Majority Leader post at the end of next month following his primary loss, but says he'll stay busy.
While I will not be on the ballot in November, I will be a champion for conservatives across the nation who are dedicated to preserving liberty and providing opportunity.
Crude oil futures are spiking this morning to around $106 a barrel on supply worries tied to unrest in Iraq. U.S. stock futures are up ahead of the weekly count of jobless claims and an update on retail sales. Yesterday was negative. The Dow was down 102. The S&P lost 7 and the NASDAQ fell 6.
The fact that we have been, you know, moving closer to the Dow 17,000 level, this seems like a pretty normal consolidation. And certainly one that doesn't seem to be disturbing the market or causing any kind of unruly selling pressure.
Eugene Peroni is with Advisors Asset Management near Philadelphia. Maybe a plan to be part of this trend. Mars Chocolate says it expects global chocolate demand to grow by more than 3% during the 2014 cocoa growing season. The company is giving a lot of credit here to demand from China, India, and Indonesia. A tweet took on a life of its own. The message contained a piece of computer code which took advantage of the company's TweetDeck application, and affected users saw pop-up windows on their screens as the tweet went out tens of thousands of times, but otherwise was reportedly harmless. And, of course, we'd mention the New York Rangers hanging on to fight another day for the Stanley Cup against the powerful L.A. Kings. The other best of seven resumes tonight as the Spurs face the Heat in Miami, with San Antonio up 2-1 in that NBA set.
All right, thank you, Gina. 8 minutes now in front of the hour on the Wall Street Journal this morning.
We help farmers make the best use of their land, which means healthier crops, higher yields, and less harvesting hours. Which is good news for a growing population and good news for the environment. BASF, the chemical company.
Small business update, and it's brought to you by Grainger. Get what you need when you need it. Call, click, or stop by today. Get it? Got it? Good. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. Soccer's quadrennial spectacle, known as the World Cup, kicks off today with Brazil as host. It's a month-long tournament that much of the planet will be watching. Just how big is it? John Kiernan, senior researcher at Wallet Hub, has put together a feature called World Cup by the Numbers. John, what jumps out?
The biggest thing, I guess, that stuck out to me is the biggest thing that's really kind of sticking out to everyone is just how much money Brazil has spent on this World Cup. The estimates are over $11 billion, up to $14, $15. And when you compare that to the $4 billion that South Africa spent in 2010, it's obviously significantly greater. And when you're considering that a lot of the construction projects haven't been completed, especially a lot of the infrastructure projects that Brazilians were kind of most hopeful about, that's really contributed to a lot of the unrest and a lot of the concern that the games won't pay off, or the World Cup won't pay off for the host country.
They spent almost, it appears, three times as much as South Africa. Did Brazil have that much more to do?
Brazil was, they're very ambitious in what they're trying to do. They're holding the World Cup in a record 12 cities and 12 venues, six of which needed to be refurbished and six were actually completely built. And that was a cost of $3.5 billion. That includes a $900 million stadium that's the second most expensive soccer arena in the world. And this isn't just about the World Cup. It's also about the 2016 Olympics in Rio.
We're speaking with John Kiernan, senior researcher at Wallet Hub, the personal finance social network. We're talking about his story about the World Cup by the numbers. That is ambitious. Tell me about some travel and tourism numbers.
Most of the tourists who are attending the World Cup are coming from Brazil and South America. The second biggest contingent behind them is the U.S. 155,000 tickets went to U.S. buyers, which was the second largest group behind Brazil, out of the 1.6 million tickets that were sold as of April 1st. And as we can kind of expect, the hotel and airline prices have gone up a lot to Brazil in recent weeks and months. The price range for economy flights from major U.S. cities to Rio is between $1,200 and $4,200 right now, and those prices are about a 40% increase relative to last year. And about 600,000 people are expected to come from abroad to Brazil for the World Cup, and they're expected to spend about $2,500 a person while they're there.
Wow. Thanks, John. John Kiernan, senior researcher at Wallet Hub. First game of the World Cup is today, 4 o'clock Eastern time. Brazil hosting Croatia. By the way, a little fact, no host team has ever lost an opening match. Pressure on Brazil. For Gina Cervetti, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to the Wall Street Journal This Morning.